Aloha, my name is Ben Ryan. I'm a professor here at the Asia Pacific Centre for Security Studies, and my area of expertise is in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Today I'm going to talk to you about humanitarian disaster relief across the Asia Pacific, but before I get into the presentation, I'd like to thank the contributors to this presentation. That's Professor Jessica Rear and Dr. Dion Canyon. What I'm going to cover in this session is disaster trends and risks in the Asia Pacific. I'll then go into emerging and cascading crises, humanitarian assistance trends, and then I'll talk about risk reduction and regional disaster cooperation. I would like to start by stating disasters are not natural. What I mean by this is that if people are not living in an area where there is disaster, it's not going to be a disaster. So on this slide, you can see a riverway. If there is a flood in this area, there is no one living there, so there will not be a disaster. So when we think about the context of the Asia Pacific, we're having large population growth or rapid urbanisation, and this is occurring in areas that are disaster prone. And what this means is as people are moving into disaster prone areas, the frequency of disasters will increase. Examples of this are, for example, in Turkey, 1999. You can see on the left-hand side of this slide, there's an earthquake there, and the buildings weren't designed for that. It was in an earthquake-prone area, which meant that when there's an earthquake, there's a high likelihood of fatalities or injuries from an earthquake. On the right-hand side, you can see in Venezuela. In this city, 50% of the people that live there are in these types of settings, in valleys, where there's houses stacked on a top of a house. So therefore, if there is a flood or heavy rains, there's a high risk of fatalities as well. And this is very common, particularly around the Asia Pacific with rapid urbanisation and people looking for somewhere to live. What often happens is as people are looking for somewhere to live, the poor and vulnerable end up in high risk disaster locations. In terms of global risk, the World Economic Forum has extreme weather events, natural disasters, and large-scale involuntary migration as the most likely with the greatest impact risks across the world. So when we're starting to think as security practitioners, we really need to consider in terms of extreme weather events, natural hazards, and involuntary migration as being key areas for us to focus. When you look at the interconnections for 2017 as well by the World Economic Forum, you can see failure to adapt to climate change and also extreme weather events is creating risks that can result in large-scale involuntary migration, water crises, food crises, biodiversity loss and ecosystem loss. And I'll talk more about this as I go through the presentation. From 1990 to 2015, the most common disasters have been floods and storms across the world. The total people affected have been mainly from floods during this period as well. Droughts have also had an impact. But when you consider the types of disasters, 62%, or just over 62%, have been floods and storms. And when you look at the Asia or Asia Pacific, you can see there's an increasing frequency of disasters. And this is arguably occurring across the world. But as you bring in rapid urbanisation in disaster-prone areas, this will continue to increase. And when you overlay Asia and the Pacific or Oceania on this slide, you can really see this region is most at risk of disasters. The mortality rate is coming down for disasters. However, the number of people affected is on the increase. So it's now the people that are being affected we need to think about. From 1940 to 2016, 72% of those killed from a disaster were in Asia, and this also accounted for 60% of people affected. The total damage, the costs of disasters are increasing, with the greatest costs being in the Americas at 44%, followed by Asia at 40%. So disasters have economic impacts as well. Why the Asia Pacific region? Well, we can have a natural or man-made event. If you have an exposed or affected area, so people moving into disaster-prone areas, for example, plus an environmental system that is more at risk. For example, If you've had deforestation in an area and it's subject to floods or storm surge, if there's no forest there to stop or mitigate that impact, the disaster will be more severe. So this leads into seven key stresses. So there's sea level rise, population growth, as I mentioned, rapid urbanisation, or you could now call it rapid unsustainable urbanisation, industrialisation, right down to unequal socio-economic growth. So when you bring in these seven stresses, plus the disaster risk or nature of the Pacific, and it being part of the Pacific Rim, you can see that the risks for the region are quite high. So there's the Pacific Ring of Fire for the Asia Pacific, which highlights the vulnerability to the region. And it's also this region where there are emerging and cascading crises and humanitarian assistance trends that we need to consider. For example, in relation to emerging cascading crisis, we need to think about climate extremes, rapid unsustainable urbanisation, emergencies of scarcity, and biodiversity crisis. Where you have one of these four stresses tipping over and failing, you have an increased risk of conflict. So as security practitioners, these are four areas you need to think about. And these are four areas we can contribute into mitigating the risk. Because if, again, one of these tip, we can have a conflict, if not a crisis. And then if we have a disaster on top of that, it's going to become a protracted crisis as well. In terms of top climate change concerns by region, for the Asia Pacific, severe weather like floods and intense storms are the greatest for the Asia Pacific. We also need to think about droughts and water shortages for the region. Although this isn't the highest risk region in the world, it is something we really need to start to consider. Rapid unsustainable urbanisation. You can see across the world, the most dense rapid urbanisation has occurred in the Asia Pacific. You overlay this with the Pacific Rim and the disaster risk areas, you can really see this region needs to be a focus of disaster risk reduction strategies. You then also overlay that the common thread for scarcity being water. You can see on this slide that there are large portions of Asia that are vulnerable to water no longer being renewable or sustainable. And what this means is if we as security practitioners don't start to think about this, there is a real risk that this could have flow-on effects into the future that compromise security and could also result in conflict. This also goes to food security. We need to think about food security in the region, particularly with a rapidly rising population as well. Biodiversity systems, or they can also be called ecosystems, provide food diversity, fresh water, raw materials and fuel, and they can also be used to regulate climate and air quality. So we need to be thinking about ecosystems and the benefits they have for the community and the region. The reason that I suggest that we need to really focus on these stresses is drought, conflict and famine can result. And an example of how this may lead to conflict is in Syria. 60% of Syria's northeast and south suffered their worst drought, water shortages and crop failures between 2006 and 2011. You overlay this with government mismanagement and poverty, which can accelerate the decline, you increase the chances of conflict or a protracted crisis. This resulted in massive exodus to cities to access food, water and jobs, which fomented the conflict. Similar drought preceded war and conflict in Somalia, Sudan, Kenya and Ethiopia. So if we're not dealing with the four stresses I spoke about, there is the potential to ignite violence, conflict and create mass migration issues. So these are areas that as security practitioners we really need to think about, because if we don't deal with those, there may be consequences 5, 10 to 15 years down the track. Humanitarian assistance trends. There's increasing humanitarian needs, both natural and man-made. The key issue is that the current funding that's being provided is not meeting the requested funding. So there is a significant gap here. And this is creating issues and challenges for humanitarian assistance across the world. You look at global displacement and the proportion around the world. This has been increasing since 1997. And this is where we need to start to consider into our planning around humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, how we can mitigate and respond to global displacement. The major source countries of refugees are predominantly from areas outside the Asia Pacific. So that's why for the Asia Pacific, we really need to focus on cyclones, floods, storms, and also dealing with those four stresses around biodiversity and rapid unsustainable urbanisation that we really need to focus on. A useful source to help you in your planning into future years is the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. This organisation on their website indicates priorities. So this slide's priorities for 2017. There will be priorities for 2018, but it just provides some really good indicators for you to think about in your planning around humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. This does recognise risks relating to drought, cyclones, hurricanes, typhoons, tsunamis, all those various factors that make a country or a society or a community susceptible. So it's a really good planning tool, and it also indicates shifts in priorities as well. Now on to risk reduction and regional disaster cooperation. Before I get into that, we need to talk about the disaster management cycle. Now this has generally four phases. In different parts of the world, they're described differently, but basically there's preparation, response, recovery and mitigation. This includes capacity building, pre-impact, emergency, restoration and reconstruction. Throughout this process, there is risk, and that's where we can focus as security practitioners on reducing that risk. So the causes are, we've got the hazard. So for example, if you live in an area at risk of an earthquake or a tsunami, you're not going to be able to reduce the hazard. And the exposure of people into the future to hazards is going to increase as people move into more cities that are vulnerable to disasters. So when we think about causes and risk mitigation, the hazard's something that's going to be very hard for us to mitigate. The areas where we need to focus is on exposure and vulnerability. Because if we don't get exposure and vulnerability right, we're going to have increased morbidity, displacement and loss of livelihoods. How can we reduce exposure? So examples are early warning, evacuation. So evacuation is done very well around the region. For example, in the Philippines, there's some very good evacuation systems. Safe shelters. There are more and more safe shelters being built. Bangladesh and India provide great examples of safe shelters being built, particularly in cyclone-prone areas. Mass care centres, quarantine, isolation, floodplain management, so maybe dams, levees and weirs. These are the types of things we can do to reduce exposure. How can we reduce vulnerability? So really focusing at the community level. So this may, for example, be with community health sectors to reduce susceptibility of people through making sure they're healthy and resilient, they understand the medications they need to access. Reducing exposure, so maybe building codes, stronger homes, and increasing resilience for the capacity to prepare, respond and recover at the community level. These are just some of the many examples of how we can increase reduce vulnerability. So we need to focus on reduction or risk reduction. We need to move from response. Traditionally, the focus has been on disaster response or relief. We need to move to risk reduction processes because, for example, every dollar invested in preparedness or mitigation can save $7 in response costs. So that just economically shows you why we need to focus on risk reduction. Not only does it benefit economically, it also ensures the health and well-being of the community. So what this can involve is mitigating impacts from weather and climate-related disasters, and this must be a priority. For example, invest in flood management, preventative storm measures. We also need to have comprehensive planning, so sustainable urban planning and resilient infrastructure to lessen economic losses. So what that may mean is not building new infrastructure, identifying infrastructure that is at risk and working out strategies to make it more resilient. How to plan for risk reduction? First of all, you need to think about, can the risk be avoided? If so, implement prevention strategies. Then we need to think about, can the risk be reduced? If so, you can implement measures to mitigate, prepare, maybe building codes. If you can't do that, can we stop the risk from spreading? So we might contain, distance ourselves, so move people to areas that aren't prone to flooding. Can the risk be transferred? Perhaps there's donor funds, aid, multilateral or bilateral agreements and insurance. Can the risk be accepted? For example, we don't want to do anything, or maybe it costs too much, so we don't deal with it. This then leads nicely into why we should cooperate in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It saves lives and loss of property. It optimises limited resources. It allows expertise and lessons to be shared. It eases coordination and promotes coordination. It strengthens relationships and can also promote stability across the region as well. And it can create sustainable and long-term benefits as well. An example of regional disaster cooperation is through SARC, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, also ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the Pacific Islands Forum, and Secretary of the Pacific Community. These all provide avenues for regional disaster cooperation in the region. There are many opportunities this brings. It can bridge the gap between international and national systems. Forum for building trust creates a common regional identity and a common goal for peace, security, development, and capacity building. There are challenges, of course. These can include respect for national sovereignty, so difficulty in addressing political issues, reliance on external funding, and also transitions from bilateral to multilateral is where we need to be headed for regional architecture or structures to work. An example of good regional coordination or cooperation was during Hurricane Haiyan. It was the strongest storm on record to make landfall on the 8th of November 2013. At this point, there was a request for assistance from around the world, and for example, on the 10th of November, the US sent assistance in. 6 hours after the assistance was approved as well, or the request. There were 29 foreign militaries that assisted in the response as well. So it's a great example of regional cooperation. 9 of the 17 regions were impacted in the Philippines. 90% of infrastructure were destroyed as well in Tacloban, Leyte and Samar. So the lessons learned out of this is we need to have well-coordinated clusters. So the United Nations has a very useful cluster framework that can be used. And in this instance, the Philippines government applied aspects of that. Joint needs assessments can be facilitated out of this. Practicing of civil-military coordination. So you do all these aspects, you can have targeted assistance, pre-positioning of supplies, and continuously monitoring the situation. So how you can achieve best practices? So we have coordinated clusters, joint needs assessments, and you've practiced civil-military coordination. You can have enhanced predictability and develop common understanding of coordination mechanisms. This streamlines preparedness and response activities. It also allows you to have targeted assistance and pre-positioning of supplies. So this may be coordination logistics and improving the use, allocation and tracking of foreign military assets. And then continuous monitoring to allow information sharing. One of the key aspects is to ensure there are common information sharing platforms. By doing this, you can ensure everybody has the evidence and the information required for an effective response. So cooperation presents many opportunities in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. These can be structural. For example, cyclone and wind resilient buildings. Institutional. This can include decentralised funding and authority. Inclusion of women and minority groups in decision making. And it can also relate to improved data, information collection and use. Coordination can also be enhanced. So you can have standard operating procedures, transparency of assets and capabilities, improvement in communication needs, and then financial and human resources, so you can promote all hazard, comprehensive, inclusive planning and approaches, having targeted education and training for inclusion in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. So in conclusion, what we've covered in this session are disaster trends and risks in the Asia Pacific, emerging and cascading crises. We've talked about the humanitarian assistance trends and some of the priorities for the region, and risk reduction and regional disaster cooperation and the benefits for the Asia Pacific. Thank you for joining me for this podcast.